Yeah.
Oh yeah.
But it's gonna go right when it let go, so. Yeah. Sure. Oh, we're just gonna A-track it.
That's going on here too.
Oh, you got a thing in there?
Yeah. Oh, cool.
We shall now consider several cases of actual violent assault, each in its own right, raising crucial questions about the crime and cannot say about our notion of freedom. And each of course that is expressing science is justified in including a substantial of our legal system. Our first offender went on trial in Massachusetts early in 1984. David Garavedian, doing his best to adjust to prison life. 5 years ago, he committed a brutal murder. Some say the extraordinary life in a part of his brain, called the hypothalamus, might have been to blame. This was the quiet house where David Garavedian brought tragedy to the Muldoon family.
David Garavedian, a 22-year-old lawn care specialist with a reputation as a quiet, almost passive man. But Garavedian admits he killed 34-year-old Irene Muldoon last March here in the yard of her suburban home. Garavedian had been doing a survey for the Old Fox Lawn Care Company when he says he argued with his victim, strangled her, then threw several large rocks at her face. Garavedian said the pesticides he worked with poisoned his brain and caused his violent behavior, a unique defense. But yesterday, the jury's verdict made it clear they didn't believe the chemical was to blame.
David Garavedian, guilty of what?
The family of Eileen Muldoon listened as the judge imposed a mandatory sentence of life in prison. Garavedian's family grieved. The DA said Garavedian had simply lost his temper and killed in a fit of anger, which had nothing to do with pesticide poisoning. Nancy Fernandez, NBC News, Cambridge, Massachusetts.
The tragedy hit the Garavedian home, too. It came as a total surprise to his family. David had always been mild-tempered.
Sometimes I sit and I think of it, and it goes over and over in my mind, and I know there had to be some kind of an outside influence. Something that made him do what he did, that triggered his aggression in that fashion, because that just was not David.
Well, I've been trying criminal cases now for 25 years as a public defender and prosecutor, and I've seen many cases, and I frankly have very, very little quality.
Started
cruel. I started getting headaches. Bad nightmares. There was an episode with my sister.
He walked. He didn't knock. He just, you know, stormed into the room. And he said, "What are you doing on the phone?" And I said, "I just got on the phone." He said, "Get off the phone. I need to use it." And I said, "All right, I'll be off. Give me 5 minutes to get off the phone." And he said, "No, get off now. Get off the phone now." And I go, "All right." I go, "I'll get off in a second." So I asked my friend to hold on because he was yelling and it was embarrassing, right? So I walked around and I go, "David, I'll be off the phone. Just wait a minute, you know." He said, "Don't tell me to wait." And he grabbed me by the shoulder. Never even raised his voice at me, you know, so I was scared.
Could new evidence allow David a new trial? Attorney Robert Martirosian and Dr. David Bain, they are visiting Garabedian to discuss reopening his case.
David, I'll tell you the reason we're here. As you recall, during the course of the trial, we had no testimony. We weren't able to bring in any people to testify that they had been exposed to chemicals such as you've been exposed to and what reaction they might have suffered. And since that time, Dr. Baird told me that there have been similar incidents. And what I'm attempting to do to help Dr. Baird is to get a new trial on the basis of newly discovered evidence.
One case concerned a professor at Harvard Medical School, Claude Lachan. For him, the problem started with his cat. The cat had fleas and decided to dust it with a very powerful insecticide not normally available over the counter.
First, I drew a serum precaution. First, I used the dusting outside. I wore gloves. I was trying to avoid to breathe it, but for sure, there was a little cloud of powder, and I don't know how to escape at least the breathing, if not to have something.
Lachan's cat had never before been seen to harm birds or animals, but now he rapidly became an avid hunter, killing many each day. And Lachan's mood changed at the same time as his cat.
This was an extremely strange behavior, which I couldn't realize immediately until I got one evening very angry after the cat and kick him out after the cat killed. I don't remember if it was a bird or a mouse. And told to my companion that this cat has become a murderer. And then she told me that my group was extremely charmed also, and that I was in a fight with her for absolutely no details, which I was getting wrong. When she said that, I kind of realized that something was wrong, that has happened to be wrong for all the household.
The chemical which he claimed made him aggressive was carbaryl, similar to the insecticide mixed by David Garabedian.
I went to my terminal, looked in a data bank, and found out that what I was feeding was a cholinesterase inhibitor.
Carbaryl poisons cholinesterase, an important enzyme in the brain.
I immediately stopped the treatment, and I got to the house, and there was nobody home at the time. So what I did was I gave the one estimate without the owner of the house present. For some reason, during that time, I had the urge to urinate a lot more than before. I couldn't explain it. And I just urinated on near the side of the house, not on the house, just on the side there. There was a little incline. And
as I was urinating again, there's a woman standing up on the ledge. Was very angry with me. To the point where she was yelling at me. I remember that as she turned away, you know, I kind of like just tapped her on the shoulder.
You gotta tap her on the shoulder like this.
Sorry. She just turned away and gouged me in my face. And after that, it was a very very dark period. That's when I grabbed her by the neck, and I just remember squeezing.
Government, it weren't for attention, it weren't for anything really. Something inside me that was saying, well, you know, come on, do this, like, you know, sort of like the devil telling, you know, someone to sort of, you know, do this and that and the other, and you just go out and do it.
Hello. How goes?
Katerina Dalton in London is a specialist in hormonal disorders.
Josh is a murderer.
The police were accusing me of stabbing this girl 17 times. The one, a girl that I work with. I don't remember anything of that night. And for me, to kill a person the way they said I did, I just couldn't believe it.
But Sandy eventually pleaded guilty, and that's when Katerina Dalton got involved.
When I came there, she didn't really want to see me talk. She'd seen enough doctors. No one had been able to help. But I did, and I'm chatting to her, I did then look through all her documents, the prison documents, and it was not interesting. At the time of her stabbing,
had seen in Sandy over several years.
In Sandy's case, we were able to look at the precise timing of those episodes of violence, and with a statistician's help, we went through them all, and we found that they averaged 29 days between one act of violence and the next. It was on this evidence that the judge agreed to postpone sentence. And during the subsequent 5 months, I was able to treat her with progesterone, and she changed completely.
I have nightmares, and I think to myself, a person in their right mind, male or female, won't do the things that I've done in the past. And for someone to do the things that I've done, it's incredible. It frightens me to think that I did do them.
So Sandy Craddock had been found guilty, but the judge released her on condition she took daily injections of progesterone. The only recurrences of a aggression or suicidal behavior have been when needed to try progesterone dose. Case came to court, had to take the stand, swear, or act aggressive, make the decision. Normal trial, 2 cases, free will. Peter Fennick and his team at the Institute of Psychiatry in London are trying to locate the nerves responsible for Roger Bingham's epileptic seizure. Their recordings reveal a lesion which could help explain how a seizure starting in his temporal lobe led to a strange and unprovoked attack. Roger was hit by a cricket ball as a teenager. The lesion which resulted can trigger seizures in his amygdala. They can then spread via the hypothalamus to affect his motor cortex and so cause bizarre actions. Contrasting memories of the events that took place that day.
Well, in the morning in question, I was just drinking coffee and stuff. Heard the back doorbell go, and I'd seen Roger disappear around that side, so answered the back door, only to find Roger literally going round, looking up in the sky, and I just didn't know what was happening. I went to speak with Roger, and literally he just fell straight onto the floor. And at 6'6", it took me by surprise, and I thought he'd seriously hurt himself because it's a paved area. And this way, I went to his assistance, and on approaching him, I went to help him, thinking he'd fallen on the floor, fainted, and just flung him right over his body, landing on the other side of him. I went back to him again.
My perception of the events are totally different to Austin's. I was back in the lambing farm, at least half a mile away, bent over a ewe, assisting her with the delivery of her lamb. I felt a presence behind me over my right shoulder, and the shadow, as it were, fell on the straw. And it was that that made me feel I must protect myself and this ewe. And I flung my arm back round in a sort of anger to protect them. And I couldn't get hold of whatever it was. It became apparent to me that it was in fact a human being. And that I had to deal with it. The anger turned into a straight rage. Get hold of him or her, and it just built and built and built, and nothing I could do would stop it. I know to this day that if I had had a weapon, I thought something like that, I had the rage to use it, and I would have done it.
Through which the seizure was going, code 4 convention. The seizures also swept through Carter's experience was a freak event. He'd forgotten to take his medication, which normally controls his seizures. Another extraordinary story illustrates a quite different kind of mind control and epilepsy. Julie, in 1969, filmed by Boston neurologists. She's having an epileptic seizure. It's common to flail around during a acts. Certainly in those days, the seizures brought a sense of fear.
I wake up in the middle of the night with panic attacks. It's like that. You know, as a child, you feel. You don't know a thing. Why did I have a panic attack at that time?
The event which put her in the neurologist's care took place at the cinema. She'd begun to panic during a movie and took refuge in the ladies' room. In those days, Julie carried a dinner knife for protection in case in one of her panic attacks she ended up in a dangerous part of the city.
Then all the strength.
Who cared for Julie after the events of that day. He describes what happened after a seizure began in the middle of a show.
Julie did what she usually did. She had the warning that the thought of fear in the pit of her stomach. She took out the dinner knife and held it in her hand, walked into the ladies' restroom in the motion picture theater, and she looked at the mirror, and she felt as she was looking at herself as though there was a disfigurement occurring on one side of her body, and part of her face, her hand, changing in shape and size. And that alone, of course, would be horrifying to anyone, but she also had this increasing fear, which usually started her on a running attack, all the time clutching the knife, dinner knife by the handle tightly in her hand. At this unfortunate time, a young girl, Julie didn't know it at all, but just came into the restroom to freshen up. She saw Julie standing there, staring at the mirror, and it didn't appear as though there was anything wrong with Julie. And there was only one wash basin, so the young patron came up, sort of brushed against the disfigured side. And just that inadvertent brush caused Julie to react and strike out. The thing she struck out with was the knife, and this knife plunged into the chest, actually into the heart of this young girl. There was a blood-curdling scream from her. Of course, Julie's father rushed out, came into the room, and administered first aid to the stabbing victim, saving her life.
Julie did have a difficult birth, but at first she grew up as a normal child. She was allergic to chocolate, which made her aggressive, but otherwise developed as a good-natured, musically able, and creative girl. Then as she became a teenager, she had more and more frequent minor lapses of consciousness, called absent seizures. Then came the major seizures, accompanied by panic and sometimes aggression. Vernon Marr believes it was the treatment he gave Julie soon afterwards that helped her.
What we did was to put a special guiding machine on her skull and I inserted a needle gave us a very distinct outline activity. While he's resting. And also during her seizures. And then, even more controversially, Vernon Mark's team reversed the current. So, when he was reporting the activity,
we stimulated a number of different electrode pairs and got nothing. No abnormal electrical response, no seizure, no attack behavior. But there was one specific pair of electrodes in the amygdala that were stimulated only on two occasions. On the first occasion, the patient was sitting, and about some seconds after the stimulation was initiated, the patient became unresponsive and she began to stare. And then she had what was unusual in my experience, that is, facial grimacing, almost characteristic of a primitive rage response. And during this time, we noticed that the patient was producing electrical activity that looked like a seizure coming from the amygdala and the hippocampus. Quite suddenly, after some seconds of grimacing, Julie launched herself against the wall and suddenly smashing her fists against the wall. That was the first sequence. We repeated that only once. And at this time, Julie was playing a guitar and was quite unaware that any stimulation was going to take place, so that it wasn't that we initiated her responses by something that we did. There was a psychiatrist, a neuropsychiatrist, who was watching her and questioning her during the time. The same thing took place. At that time, she stopped what she was doing. She stopped playing. She stared. She had the facial grimacing. And then the psychiatrist was saying, "Julie, Julie, can you hear me? Can you open your eyes? Stick out your tongue." And all of a sudden, Julie struck out and smashed out with the guitar, smashing it into pieces on the wall. After we had identified the abnormal focus, we destroyed the tiny bit of tissue around the electrode by increasing the temperature using radiation, making a small lesion, determining what would happen to Julie, waiting for a while, aggressive attacks at all during the last 15 to 18 years.
I know that is all in the past.
That's what you think.
The cinema problem. And let's say that which was nightmare doesn't have to be nightmare anymore. I'm very happy. I feel happier than I was before. And I'm hoping it won't end. Just as, my goodness, any miracle in life could be.
Since Julie had her brain operation, more effective anticonvulsant medication has become available.
Any miracle in life could be.
Since Julie had her brain operation,
my goodness, any miracle in life could be.
Since Julie had her brain operation, more effective.
Just as, my goodness, any miracle in life could be.
Since Julie had her brain operation, more
effective. It won't end.
Just as, my goodness, any miracle in life.
Julie had her brain operation.
More effective anticonvulsant medication has become available. And violent attacks by people with epilepsy have become even less common.
But scientifically, there can be no better demonstration of the relation between events in the brain and an aggressive act than the recording of the electrical discharges of a seizure at the moment of the act. Recording the regions of the brain known to be involved in the control of rage, fear, and violence. The irony here is that from a widely accepted scientific point of view, all our thoughts derive from electrical activity in nerve cells. In Philadelphia, listening to the band, John Smith and his wife remember a time 12 years ago when he was a train engineer. That was when John first saw this barred lawyer, amateur conductor, Jay Centofanti.
Here is our signature tone. You know it. We don't. Toot, 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 toot.
Today, Jay is in control of himself. But then he was a manic depressive, armed and on the run. Checking on him again today is psychiatrist Bob Sadoff.
Jay, how's it going? Much better. You feel that things have kind of stabilized for you?
Yes, especially given that the real world problems are still there, many of them.
Oh, yeah.
I just handle them differently.
How do you do that? What's different?
I guess I don't feel as driven about everything. I don't feel like I have to achieve the A-plus level all the time. Back off.
Is that a psychological thing for you, or do you think the driven factor might have had something to do also with the chemical imbalance?
I have no doubt. It was something like I couldn't stop. I couldn't sleep.
One night in 1975, Jay came here with a gun to wait for his wife and her boyfriend.
It was about 11:30 at night. It was dark. I had been drinking. I'd had one or two joints of marijuana. At that point, I just intended to wait. I was in a very, very hyper-manic state. I had everything was clicking like a computer. I knew where to be and how to be because were telling me that that was the way I was supposed to behave. I was supposed to wait and get on the train and show them the gun and try to scare them.
Jay thought he was getting messages in light.
The very first message that I received was coming from some heavenly or satanic power. I wasn't sure what it was as I boarded the train. And it said, shoot her now. I don't remember what happened at this point. I know I ended up on the train. They were sitting in the second seats here on the left with their backs to me as I got on the train. Then I don't remember a whole other section of what happened.
It was then he shot his wife twice in the head, but subsequent bullets hit her in the back.
I came to, I'd already shot her. I had no recollection of that part. And the message to me at that point was, you don't want to kill her. And that was the operative instruction. That was the thing that I remembered. I shot her three more times. I don't remember anything after that. And I'm moving toward the engineer's cabin at the end of the train. They tell me that I terrorized everyone on the train. I have no recollection of that. I came up the car. There were apparently people sitting on either side of the train. I don't remember that. I don't remember anyone in my way or anyone else in the car at all. John, what happened?
Well, I was ordered at some point to leave the train.
And then what did you do? I don't remember.
I opened the door and split down the grab line and emergency brakes went along the town of the throttle.
And then what did I do? I don't remember this part of it.
Who gets off first,
John? I'll get off, John. Thank you. I don't remember this part.
Yeah.
So, what are you trying to say?
assumed that he must be mad to shoot the way he did. And I didn't know just what he did until I saw the wife up on the abutment and bleeding from her back. Then I knew it was very serious. So I went back on the train, phoned the police, walked through the train. I saw blood on about five backs of the seats.
All I remember is coming up onto this embankment, which went on for some feet, about 20 yards. And then having another message, another very clear, lighted message that said, run, just run. And that's basically what I did. I came along here. There were a whole series of small pathways. I remember jumping down to one and then just coming up this hill. So I just climbed up here as fast as I could. Over the trail. And I just don't remember what happened from here until I got to the church. Just knowing that I needed to find some place that was quiet where I could be by myself.
So Jay came to this church on Pine Street, where he hid undetected for 6 weeks. Jay's pastor, Bill Pindar, remembers this time vividly. Unlike Jay, Bill knew Jay's wife had survived the attack, as had the other injured passengers.
The Sunday after this took place, we prayed for Jay, for his wife, for her recovery, and the prayers were we wanted Jay to come home. Well, unknown to me, he did come home, and he left some clues for us. Little clues like doors were unlocked and unbolted. Clues of being around places, making little noises. My hunches were subconsciously that he was around. But my conscious mind couldn't quite get a hold of that until some very strong evidence I found one morning while he was still at loose. I discovered a book. Was sitting on a couch. Oh, I had loaned Jay and his wife at that time a book. The book was Carl Rogers' On Becoming a Person. I thought, my God, On Becoming a Person. How ironic that he would leave this book. And then when I opened it up, inside the book was an alarming piece of script. And it was a suicide note, a very, very meticulous outlined note of how he was going to end his life. Again, my heart jumped around a lot because I knew that Jay was going to preach again, and I knew that he was thinking of taking his life, so I knew that I had to take some action. So I called the detectives and said, here, I don't know what to make of this, except I know Jay's in trouble. And I don't know where he is, and I'm not sure how this book got into the locked church. Oh, I found out later that he was hiding right up in the attic of the church. And he could look down through the grate and watch us and see us on Sunday mornings.
The first night that I hid in the church, I hid under the altar, where I knew that there was a space. The second night, I got another message. The message was, go upstairs. And I knew there was no upstairs, other than what you could see the balcony. But the message was insistent that I come upstairs. So I came upstairs, and it was then that I discovered that there was a doorway through this organ console, which is just the front. Through the doorway, I looked, and saw that there was an entrance into the roof. And that's where I went.
stole food from the church refrigerator to survive. It was a time he finds it very hard to describe.
I didn't know this existed until the message came that I should come up with. And then once I was here, it became my home. It became the place. It's been overused, but I have to say it. It became my sanctuary. This is where I found myself. This is where I came to terms, I think, for the first time with. Days before I knew she was alive, and then I was not sure what to do with that. I didn't know whether I wanted to kill her again, try to kill her again. Came up here. I looked down through the chandelier, and I saw Bill walking, just as he walked in there. I sat here and listened to him. Deliver my eulogy. And he was certain, I think, at the time that I killed myself. And that no trace of me had made the effect. And I sat here and it was positive in the pop. And I was like, I got Mark Twain, Huckleberry, or whoever it is, listening to his own funeral.
You could see him with your wife down there?
Yes. Well, I could see Bill on the pulpit, and I could see my ex-wife sitting with police protection in one of the pews down there in the sun. It couldn't have been the Sunday after the shooting. It must have been a week or so afterward.
Did you feel aggressive towards her still?
Yeah.
What did you think?
I thought I could stay here for a while. I told you. I told you once that this was the only peace that I'd ever really known. There's a part of me that comes back here in my mind. In 18 days without stopping, first draft. That's what I felt like most of the time. And I don't think that it was completely unpleasant to have that energy and to have that drive. It's very seductive. But the problem is you can't turn it on and off. Influence from outside. And now I think
I'm the same as everyone else. At least I appear to be. I mean, I know folks who have much more wide mood swings than I do, who are not diagnosed and who are not on lithium. The difference being that those people don't shoot people, and I have. But the problem is you can't turn it on and off. From outside, and now I think I'm the same as everyone else. At least I appear to be. I mean, I know folks who have much more wide mood swings than I do, who are not diagnosed and who are not on lithium. The difference being that those people don't shoot people, and I have more wide mood swings than I do, who are not diagnosed and who are not on lithium. The difference being that those people don't shoot people, and I have. Don't shoot people, and I have. Diagnosed and they are not on lithium. The difference being that those people don't shoot people, and I have. The difference being that those people don't shoot people, and I have. 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 I have.